Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCBW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. How Salt Lake City tried to keep the Bees baseball team and why it didn't work. With projections showing a 71-foot rebound coming, Lake Powell resumes Grand Canyon's experimental floods. And a Utah woman couldn't find a good list of dog-friendly places in Salt Lake City, so she started making one. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune City and County reporter Blake Apgar. Blake, welcome to the program. So he needs to unmute. We welcome in Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley. Welcome to the program. Let's see. I wonder if we have a problem here. Do we have the... Let's see. I think we have a Zoom problem here. Let's go to a brief break here and try to get Zoom reconnected.
This is Wild About Utah. Back in October 2019, the ranger at the Great Salt Lake State Park began to notice a white mound forming on the sand flats behind the visitor center. The white mounds turned out to be made up of a hydrated sodium sulfate known as mirabilite that was being carried to the surface by an upwelling of a freshwater spring. Since the 1940s, geologists have known that in this area, 30 inches below the surface, there was a 3 to 6 foot shelf of mirabilite. They knew about the freshwater springs. What was new was cold air. Since this stretch of sand was no longer underwater, the mirabilite carried to the surface stayed there as crystals, piling up on each other, puddling, and spreading out. One mound rose to the height of 3 feet. So when the mound started to form again this winter, I jumped at the chance to go and take a look. I must admit at first I was a little underwhelmed at the size, perhaps because the Kennecott smelter stack nearby dominates the view, rising to 1,215 feet, roughly the same height as the Empire State Building. But the park ranger got my attention when she told us that the mirabilite mounds have only been seen in 4 places in the entire world, the Canadian Arctic, Antarctica, central Spain, and Utah. Just seeing them turns out to be a rare winter treat. When the air warms to 50 degrees, the mirabilite will crumble into a fine white powder and disappear. My mind flashed back to a trip I'd made on the other end of the lake 10 years ago. I'd just graduated from the docent training class at the Utah Museum of Fine Art, and a friend and I wanted to celebrate by having high tea at the center of the spiral jetty, a 1,500-foot-long, 15-foot-wide coil of black rock, a stunning example of land art jutting out from the northern shore. We'd been warned that it might be underwater, but when we arrived, we were delighted to find we could easily walk to the very center of the spiral as the lake water gently lapped at the edges of our shoes. We clinked our teacups and toasted the greatness of the lake. Suddenly, I wanted to see the jetty again, and I hopped in my car and drove to the remote site. I saw the spiral jetty was now high and dry. Drifting sand had already started to bury parts of it. The water's edge was over 300 yards away. I thought of the millions of migratory birds that would be arriving in the spring to rest and feast on the tiny treasures of the lake, the brine shrimp. I hoped a smaller lake would still be able to take care of them all. The recent words of the director of the Friends of the Great Salt Lake, Linda Freitas, rang in my head. The Great Salt Lake is a gift that keeps on giving. Just add water. This is Mary Hears, and I'm Wild About Utah.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We lost internet connection, which of course zaps Zoom. So we're going to old-fashioned method here. We've got our reporters on the phone. And so I believe we do have on the phone city and county reporter Blake Apgar.
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Hey. Yeah, sorry about the troubles here. I think we also have on the phone public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you bet, Tom. I'm on board here.
Very good. And we're working on getting on the phone Pollock Jaiswal and Robert Gerke. So, Splend, let's start with Blake. So your story is titled "How Salt Lake City Tried to Keep the Bees a Baseball Team and Why It Didn't Work." Of course, we know the Bees have announced that they're going to be moving to Daybreak, right, in Sandy.
Yeah. So, this all really started about the spring of 2021. Early conversations as the Bees are coming up on the end of their lease. That is up at the end of next season. And so there were some really early conversations back in 2021 about all the things that Smith's Ballpark needed, just a laundry list of upgrades. After the Bees announced they were going to leave, I put in a records request with Salt Lake City and asked for, all of the communication between the mayor and her executive staff, between the city, that staff, and the leadership of the Larry H. Miller Company, which owns the Bees. And what I got back was, those early emails that show, okay, here are the upgrades we need. But where the conversation really started getting kind of robust was in January of 2022. That's when you see the mayor's office really starting to dig in and try and make a deal to keep the team in Salt Lake City.
It's kind of fascinating to see the behind the scenes. What were the Bees' concerns? Why did they potentially want to leave?
So it's not outlined in the email, but the Larry H. Miller Company owns about 1,300 acres in Daybreak, and so ultimately, as the mayor has characterized it, the Bees' departure was a business decision for LHM to anchor a development down in Daybreak. If looking through the emails, though, it's clear that there are some concerns about public safety in the ballpark neighborhood. There are questions about the future redevelopment of that neighborhood, and there are questions about getting those upgrades that we talked about earlier.
So, from the city's point of view, what I guess it's a concern having a potential economic driver like that leave.
Yeah, of course, I think it's pretty clearly spelled out in those emails just how important it was to the city to keep the team here in Utah's capital.
And I believe the city sees this as an already struggling area, so a kind of a blow.
Yeah. I mean, the mayor is pretty clear in her emails that, you know, the stadium is an important part of the neighborhood. It was really the central focus in this redevelopment plan that was passed late last year. It's called the Ballpark Station Area Plan for anyone who wants to get in the weeds on it. But it really envisioned West Temple. West Temple and 13th South is the hub of activity for the ballpark neighborhood. And the stadium played a crucial role in that. Now, I've asked about that plan and whether the B's departure upends it. The city is pretty clear in saying, like, you know, no, this is still the heart of the neighborhood. We're still going to make investment there. And the mayor's office really took the team's announcement that they were leaving to South Jordan as an opportunity to pitch a new future for the ballpark neighborhood, something with a development that could bring activity to the area 365 days a year, not just during a baseball season.
So they're moving forward there. I guess they have high hopes there.
Yeah. I mean, it really is kind of an uncommon situation where you get about 13 acres of developable city-owned land in the middle of a built-out city like Salt Lake City. And so, there is, I think, an appetite to see that there's some sort of catalytic project that goes into that neighborhood.
In the meantime, the Mayor Mendenhall says the kind of separate proposals, talks about bringing a Major League Baseball team to Utah, didn't enter into these negotiations.
Yeah, that's right. She says that, I mean, if we rewind a couple weeks, the Larry H. Miller Company announced, in the middle of April that they were going to pursue a Major League Baseball team. The mayor said that she was not brought into that specific conversation until January and after, LHM decided to move the Bees. And so she says that the talks that have been publicized now have never factored in into the discussions about keeping the Bees. But, there are records that show her chief administrative officer, Lisa Schaefer, sending an email to CEO of LHM, his name's Steve Starks, and saying, hey, we've heard about talks about Major League Baseball coming here, and we think that, we can and we should be talking about a way to prepare for that while we also negotiate a lease for keeping the Bees here. And I just don't, it doesn't come up again, and so it's hard to say like how far that conversation went. But the mayor says she wasn't aware of or part of any conversation to bring MLB here, at least with respect to the Larry H. Miller Company's efforts.
Well, it's probably a good segue to transition to your other story this week. Here's the headline. Before the Millers announced Major League Baseball plans, the ballpark site on Salt Lake City's west side was pitched to another famous Utahn. Who's that other famous Utahn?
Yeah, that conversation centered around discussions with Jazz owner Ryan Smith. Folks may remember that back in August, Smith said he was interested in bringing another professional sports team to Utah, had partnered with a sports investment firm to help make that happen. And so, just a couple of weeks later, in mid-September, the mayor's office was approached by Mortenson Construction. It's the construction company that's working with Rocky Mountain Power on the power district along North Temple. That's where the Millers proposed ballpark would be. So they were looking at this location back in at least September, and it was initially pitched to Ryan Smith. Mortensen contacted the city, talked to the mayor. The mayor helped make the introduction with Ryan Smith.
And it looks like in his emails, the mayor thought that Ryan Smith was, you know, kind of positive about this. It turned out, in the end, he sort of lost interest.
Yeah, you know, there were a couple of conversations between the mayor and Ryan Smith. They went out to the power district and walked around the site. She said that he was really intrigued by the site, and you know, intrigued by Rocky Mountain Power's willingness to be a partner in this. And then it's just kind of fizzled out, at least by early December. She said she had lunch with Ryan Smith, and he had mentioned, or at least at that point, that MLB was no longer on his radar.
So tell me about this area. I think it's still the area that they're kind of pointing to, the Power District site.
Yeah, so it falls within the city's redevelopment agency North Temple project area. So the redevelopment agency has some financial tools, some public financing options to help breathe new life into the area. And so that was one topic of brief conversation. Those financing options are pretty widely available to RDA projects in general. And so, you know, there was some communication from the redevelopment agencies and on what was available in a financing package. But it's, you know, that site is appealing to the city because, you know, there's just been a longstanding effort to revitalize that stretch of North Temple. We're talking just east of Redwood Road on North Temple. But you know, there's a pitch from now LHM side, and certainly the city would back this. It's, you know, it's ideally situated along a gateway to the city. It's on a tracks light rail line. It is a stone's throw away from an international airport. It is close to downtown. It's near Interstate 80. And so, you know, that's why there's a lot of interest in this site.
Hmm. Of course, Major League Baseball, you know, not a done deal. That'd be a ways away, but I guess Salt Lake's in the running.
Yeah. You know, there's certainly some optimism among the Larry H. Miller Company and the city and this broad coalition of business and civic and government leaders who are backing the effort to bring the league here.
In the meantime, I'm reading from your story, Ryan Smith he's publicly announced he's maybe interested in bringing a National Hockey League team to Salt Lake.
Yeah, you know, it's tough because it's, I mean, he said so in two words on Twitter in response to a prompt from someone else saying he should bring, you know, bring the league here. He said it was in motion. But I'm not familiar with any of the discussions in Smith's inner circle or really any inside conversations about National Hockey League.
Oh, I see. It's just kind of a brief mention. So don't hold your breath at this point, I guess. So. All right. Very good. Blake Apgar, City and County Reporter. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Hope you stay on a little later for the underplayed stories of the week. Robert Gerke, what do you think about the Bees or Major League Baseball?
Well, my takeaway from Blake's story, and it's great reporting, is it just felt like the Miller Group was never very serious about trying to keep the team in the ballpark neighborhood, that the decision had already been made and their negotiation was just maybe a hedge. And frankly, the notion is if they were serious about getting a major league team, you know, the idea of building a new ballpark in Daybreak seems, I don't know, far-fetched or maybe wasteful, just because I don't see any way that there's that the Valley, the Salt Lake Valley writ large, can keep can sustain a major league team and a minor league team. So it's a big commitment to try to relocate the Bees. I think maybe that's why they were looking for the short-term lease with the ballpark neighborhood. So, there's a lot of things in motion. I would love to see a major league team come to town. I'm not sure that it's in the cards. It feels like the Miller Group's kind of hedging their bets with this ballpark in South Jordan. So it's a lot of movement, and I think, Blake captured it well in the lead of the story where, you know, ballpark neighborhood's the one that's kind of left out in the cold. You know, the North Temple neighborhood kind of gets the potential, at least, for a big investment and fusion of sort of a vibrant, ballpark and surrounding supporting businesses. South Jordan gets their team, you know, when the Bees move. We're still kind of curious to see what they end up doing with the ballpark to revitalize that neighborhood. So a lot of wheels turning here.
It's the news columnist Robert Gerke providing commentary for us, and we just heard from Blake Apgar, Salt Lake Tribune City and County reporter. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams. Coming up following a break, we're going to take a look at the results of very wet winter here. One of those results, resumption of an experimental floods in the Colorado River. And we'll be talking with Brian Maffley. More following this break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We turn next to public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, sure thing.
So here's the headline. With projections showing a 71-foot rebound coming, Lake Powell resumes Grand Canyon's experimental floods. So I guess, Brian, it's been that kind of a winter,
yeah.
Wet enough that we can resume. How long has it been since we had an experimental flood?
Yeah, they started doing them on an annual basis in 2012, but since 2018, they stopped doing them, you know, for a couple reasons. But the main one was just the hydrology on Lake Powell, wasn't all that conducive to it. That obviously has changed this year. And so there's a lot of takeaways, you know, from the Bureau of Reclamation's decision here, one of which is, okay, they're getting to do these experimental floods again. But the other thing is the projections for the amount of water that's going to flow into Lake Powell are substantially higher than initially anticipated. And they're to the point where they are planning to, you know, for this water year, release 9.5 million acre feet of water downstream. Now, why that's significant is normally it's like 7.5 million acre feet. So, you know, a big... 35% increase in the amount of water that's going to be released from Lake Powell. And some people might say, well, why would they do that? I mean, Lake Powell is so low. It's, 150 feet lower, or more than it is when it's full. Well, they need to balance the level of Lake Powell with Lake Mead downstream, which is an even bigger reservoir. And so this is, all pretty promising. So it's, not surprising anybody that, that Lake Powell's going to rebound. But what was surprising was that, between it's hitting its historic low, which occurred on April 13th, I think at the elevation of 3,519 feet above sea level, over the course of the summer, it's going to peak at 72 feet higher, which is huge. That's as big as the Salt Lake Tribune building, right? That I'm sitting in right now. And then by the end of the water year, it'll settle back down. We initially called it a 50-foot bump in our headline, but when a reader phoned me and said, look, you know, you're forgetting that it's going to peak in July at almost 3,600 feet. And it's still pretty low. Like in my reporting, we point out that at the end of the water year, which is September 30th, the lake is still only going to be 38% full. So there's a lot more water can get into that lake. So it's not like, you know, its problems aren't solved yet. But this is remarkable that these high flow experiments can resume after such a long hiatus. And maybe we could talk a little bit about why they're important, Tom.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so what happens, what the Grand Canyon Dam did to the Colorado River was it now operates the water flowing out of Flint Canyon, instead of, you know, being natural with high water in the spring and intermittent flooding, it's this constant flow rate that is based on the needs of electrical power generation. So the dam just basically eliminated the natural flooding that would normally occur through the Grand Canyon. And so what the Bureau did to try to rectify this was come up with a program for having these high releases that kind of mimic the natural flooding that would occur in the spring. And they usually happen in, you know, late April. And the point of doing this is that there's all this sediment kind of accumulates at the mouths of some of the tributaries, down canyon, down from Lee's Ferry. The major one is the Paria River that comes in just below Lee's Ferry. That's the river that drains Bryce Canyon in that area. And so all this sediment accumulates at the mouth of these tributaries, and there's nothing, you know, there isn't high water to push it downstream. And why that's important is this is the sediment that creates sandbars and beaches in the Grand Canyon. And so without that, you know, the spring floods, well, these important beaches get lost. And they serve as habitat for plants and animals. And they're also great to camp on if you're, you know, fortunate enough to raft the river. And so these experiments, they generally last for 72 hours. So this one just ended yesterday. They help, you know, restore those beaches. And they keep careful track of what's going on. The National Park Service is kind of responsible for that. So the resumption of these experiments, I think, is an important milestone.
Tell me about the end of your story. It's very interesting. Tell me about the smallmouth bass. I guess there's a...
Oh, God. Yeah.
It's a predatory non-native species. They're trying to keep it out of the bottom of the river.
Well, there's so many things go wrong when the water level of Lake Powell drops. And one of the biggest is that the lake elevations at Lake Powell fluctuate pretty wildly at these elevations, and the water coming out of the Grand Canyon Dam it warms, because the lower the lake level is, the warmer the water is that goes through the hydroturbines. And what's happened, the biologists have discovered, is this non-native predatory fish, smallmouth bass. They're a great sport fish, but they don't belong in the Colorado River. They've been, for whatever reason, been stocked into Lake Powell, and now it turns out that they are able to pass through the hydroturbines and survive, and now they're replicating downstream in Marble Canyon. And the reason why this is a real problem is that they're preying on the native fish, that some of which are endangered. And the hope is that this can be stopped. The passage of smallmouth bass can be stopped going through the dam, but at low levels, it's probably not possible. So one of the solutions that they're looking at, and it's under environmental review right now, is to kind of adjust the releases so the water coming through the dam is cooler than it otherwise would. And with cooler water, smallmouth bass probably won't survive. their entry into the Colorado River. So yeah, the whole thing with the bass is just one of like many things that are going wrong on the Colorado River because of these chronically low levels of water flowing through the system.
One last thing on the story, Brian. So you're saying that experts are saying at the peak in July be 71 feet above the historic low. But that would still not be full pool, right?
Yeah, but it's still quite a bit lower than full pool. Yeah. That we experienced 20 years ago,
And only 39% of its capacity, I guess, even at 71 feet up.
Yeah, because that's at the end of the water year. The end of the water year will be 35.75, and that's the date we really should be looking at. And that's 125 feet below full pool.
Okay.
I'm sorry, 35.76. I'm correcting myself. I'm just looking at my story right now.
Yeah.
Not in numbers. I know. It gets kind of difficult.
It does.
And
as you mentioned earlier, you got to think about Lake Mead as well. So Lake Powell has to release some water so Lake Mead can have some.
Yeah. And that's part of the operating guidelines for both reservoirs. Depending on what elevations they're at, they adjust the amount of water passing through to kind of balance the two lakes. And Lake Mead is almost as badly depleted as Lake Powell. And I think, if it push came to shove, they had to, save the operations of one of these reservoirs. It would be, Lake Mead would probably take precedence just because it's so important water source for agriculture and big cities downstream in California and Nevada.
Well, Brian Maffley, thank you so much. Public lands and environment reporter. Hope you stay tuned or stay on for the underplayed story of the week. So, Robert Gerke, what do you think about the water situation, Colorado River?
I mean, obviously, it's good news that we're getting the water. The Lake Powell, Colorado River management had been a real headache for the last couple of years. This is a bit of a brief reprieve, at least. I was on the San Juan recently, and it's high. I mean, it was flowing really well, especially for this early in the year. And hopefully these the flows out of the dam that they're talking about do take care of some of the silt because there's so much of it that's been built up. So it's an opportunity, I think, for us to kind of address some of these issues that need to be taken care of, but also, I fear it's sort of a short-term reprieve too. We can't stop focusing on the long-term health of the river and the tributaries and so forth. It'd be foolish to think that just because we have one huge water year and the lake comes back up that that the long-term issues have been resolved.
Well, let's go to another break. That's Robert Gerke, news columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. We just talked with Brian Maffley, public lands and environment reporter. Coming up following the break, we're going to be talking with culture reporter Palak Jaiswal. A Utah woman couldn't find a good list of dog-friendly places in Salt Lake City, so she made one. We'll talk about that story following this break.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. And we turn next to Salt Lake Tribune culture reporter Palak Jaiswal. Palak, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. So the headline here, your story, she couldn't find a good list of dog-friendly places in Salt Lake City, so she started making one. Who are we talking about here?
So this is a story about Brandy Chenoweth and her 5-year-old golden retriever, Scout. Brandy is originally from Idaho, which she characterizes as a very dog-friendly city. So when she and Scout, kind of moved here, she was a bit surprised that Salt Lake City wasn't similar in that sense.
So she started something called Dog Friendly SLC. What is this?
Yeah, so that's kind of, I guess you could say, their brand name of all of this scoping out of businesses and parks and those types of places they do. They have an Instagram account, which has about 15,000 followers or so, and they're really big on TikTok, which is where I found them. And a lot of their content is just similar to what my story is they go to places and they see if it's friendly for Scout, and then they post about it.
So if you get a post on Dog Friendly, if you're a restaurant or something, get a post on Dog Friendly SLC, apparently it's got a lot of power. She went to, I can't remember the name of the restaurant, did a post on it. She says they're going to be flooded with dogs for at least 2 weeks.
Yeah, so we went to Cafe Juniper, which is in the Church and State building. And when we were sitting down with our coffees and stuff, Brandy had mentioned that just a few weeks back, she did a post on a dog-only pool. And when she called to book Scout in for a swim a couple weeks later, the pool had a three-week waiting list. And so this content that they're creating, you know, it's pretty powerful.
So my understanding from your story is you can't have dogs in restaurants. So how was Scout there?
Definitely. So there is, you know, some health code kind of prohibitions. I got to speak with someone from the Salt Lake County Health Department and they confirmed, you know, that Utah kind of has a rule that prohibits dogs from restaurant patios. There is kind of a variance option that allows food service establishments, you know, to have dogs on their outdoor patios, but you have to apply to be certified and that kind of stuff. Of course, this is probably, this is for, you know, health concerns. Part of that variance is, you know, making sure the dog has a rabies vaccine and that kind of stuff. But the 2022 list that the Salt Lake County Health Department puts up on their website named about 44 approved businesses. So it is a pretty robust list, but it also, you know, you have to take into consideration, as both Brandy and the spokesperson from the Salt Lake County Health Department pointed out to me, that not everyone likes dogs, unfortunately. And so you have to keep those types of things in mind, as well as, you know, health concerns.
Brandy said that she characterized Boise, as you said, as a super dog friendly place. She found Salt Lake City to be less so. What makes a particular establishment dog friendly?
That is a very good question. And that's exactly what I asked Brandy. And she said that bottom line, what makes a place dog friendly is the businesses want to be dog friendly. Now, of course, we have to take into consideration, you know, health codes and stuff like that, like we just talked about. But it's a lot to have a business consider, right? So they have to have a permit. If it's a dog friendly hotel, they have to have extra costs, you know, for cleaning, for dog hair and stuff like that. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. But one of my favorite quotes from the story is Brandy saying that at the bottom of all of this, of how Dog Friendly started, it was just the idea that she wanted to bring her dog with her to brunch. And so Brandy is very understanding and very knowledgeable about, you know, why dogs aren't allowed in certain places. And she is in constant communication with the Salt Lake County Health Department to make sure that, you know, places that she is posting about or gets tips about, are okay, are approved, and dogs are allowed there.
I guess if you're an establishment and you want to get your place touted on her list, I guess you could contact the site, right?
You could, yeah. Of course, you know, there's that permit process. And when I wrote this story and I spoke to the spokesperson, they had said that their 2023 list will be coming out relatively soon. And they said that 90% of businesses usually renew their permits for having dogs in their establishment. So it'll be really interesting, I think, to see how dog-friendly businesses grow, just because, you know, we've had such a big population boom here in Utah, and so many people are bringing their furry friends along with them. So,
At the end of your story, you have Brandy and Scout's top five dog-friendly places in Utah. I guess there's some Salt Lake, there's some Park City, and Huntsville here.
Yeah, that was a very fun question. I wanted to put together kind of a list of places that Brandy and Scouts both loved, but it was a very difficult question for Brandy to answer because she had so many great places to name. I think the range of the five places on that list is great. There's restaurants, you know, there's Templin Family Brewing, for example, and then there's, you know, dog parks and national forests and just places to bring your dog out into the beautiful nature we have in Utah.
Apparently Snow Basin Resort has a dog-friendly gondola.
Yes. I made a joke that this is a gondola that maybe everyone will like. So.
Yeah, probably so. Well, Pollock, maybe just very, very briefly, just 1 minute on another story I wanted to have you talk a bit about. We'll have to be very brief on this. The headline is, Women in Utah have been advocating for clean air for a century. You visited an exhibit.
Yeah, so this is actually a digital exhibit, so anyone can have access to it. It's linked in the story. It's an exhibit put together by the University of Utah's Marriott Library and Logan E. Mitchell, who is a climate scientist at Utah Clean Energy and used to be a professor of atmospheric science at the U. It's a very cool, very comprehensive look at Utah's history of air quality and air quality advocacy. And one of the aspects of this was that women have been advocating for clean air in Utah for almost over a century. And it was just really interesting to talk to Logan and Rachel Jane Whitman from the U, who kind of explained, you know, decades ago, it was women who were trying to figure out how to get coal smoke and like debris out of clothing and household items. And now one of the more modern groups we have here in Utah is Utah Moms for Clean Air. So I got to talk to them about stuff that they've done, you know, for the past couple of decades and just kind of compare it and paint a timeline to see that, yeah, women have been advocating for clean air for a very long time in Utah, and they still are.
Well, check out that story at sltrib.com. Pollock Jaswal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Very shortly, we'll go to our underplayed stories of the week. Before we did that, I wanted to make sure we got time to talk to Robert. Well, first, I want to talk about your piece on the Draper home collapses in the legislature. But, Robert, any comment on Pollock stories?
Oh, I mean, they're great stories. They're people kind of taking charge of their own stuff and doing, you know, filling a void that I think a lot of people obviously are eager to have. We've heard my dogs join me on the program before, and they I'm eager to take them to check some of these places out.
Let's turn to your piece here just recently this week. So the headline is, a Utah geologist warned of a Draper home collapse in 2010, and Robert Gerke explains how the legislature let it happen. How's the legislature involved here?
Well, so this development, back when it was initially proposed, the scientist that the geologist I spoke to up at the University of Utah had done a study in 2010, kind of highlighting a lot of the risks that were involved in building on this Traverse Mountain area. It had been, you know, because of the steep slopes and the geology there, it had been prone to a lot of slides. And she, at the time, you know, cited that there was about $500 million of property at risk at that point. And obviously, it's just grown exponentially since then. She actually said when she first moved to Utah in 2005, she was looking for a place to live and went and looked at Traverse Mountain and you know, because her husband was working in Lehigh, and it was just not anywhere that she said she would ever live because of, she could see just from the looking at the landscape that it was prone to slide. But, you know, the city, the mayor of Draper told me that they, you know, are very limited in what they're able to do in terms of, you know, they can't really reject developments. They had tried in the past, and the courts had told them that they either had to buy out the property or, you know, approve the development. And so they've been limited by the legislature in what they're able to do to try to shape these and make them safe for the home buyers. And also, you know, in terms of home buyers making informed decisions. There's really not requirements that they be informed that homes are built in an area that is prone to slides. So, you know, the scientist I talked to, Kathleen Nicole, said she was heartbroken when she saw this home fall into the ravine, these two homes fall into the ravine, because she had kind of seen that it was something that could have happened all along, and was really sad to see it. So when the mayor told me that the next step is they're trying to get this cleaned up and then they'll figure out what went wrong, and I'm hoping that the legislature looks at, you know, maybe empowering cities a little bit more to try to impose some requirements to ensure the safety of these developments. But as we've talked about before on the program, the legislature is very pro-developer. It's made up largely of developers or people with real estate interests. And so it's not, you know, I'm not holding my breath that they're actually going to, that we'll see any progress on it as a result of this collapse.
You can find Robert's piece in the sltrib.com as well. Let's do turn now to Underplayed Story of the Week. We'll start with Blake Apgar. What's your Underplayed Story of the Week?
Yeah, so Tony Summerhead had a story out today about Salt Lake City considering a package of incentives that have some implications for density throughout Utah's capital. It's part of a suite of affordable housing incentives that are meant to fast-track some affordable housing options.
All right, check that story out at sltrib.com. Brian Maffley, what's your Underplayed Story of the Week?
Yeah, I'm going to second what Blake just said, but I really enjoyed the story that Palak did about the independent booksellers in Utah, which he co-wrote with Sophia. If for whatever reason, independent booksellers seem to be thriving in Utah against, you know, the trends elsewhere in the country. It's a good read.
So, Palak Jaiswal, what's your Underplayed Story of the Week?
Mine is, and I'm so glad no one stole it, is a story by Emily Anderson Stern that went up yesterday, one of our State Watch reporters. It's a story on the Utah legislature not funding the Utah State Prison's nursery. And Emily told a very just moving story of two sisters who had newborn babies, and I can't possibly do it any justice describing it like this, but I think everyone should read this story. Emily did really great reporting.
You can find that at sltrib.com. Yeah, that was a very interesting, touching story. Robert Gerke, what's your Underplayed Story of the Week?
Well, Palak stole my Underplayed Story of the Week, so but I will ditto what she said. It's worth taking the time to read that. And I will plug a story that actually both Brian Schott and I wrote about this week, and it was a little bit of a blow-up that happened at the Republican convention, where a conspiracy theorist confronted Spencer Cox about smart cities, which are sort of a conspiracy theory that involves forcibly living, you know, a UN World Economic Forum plan to force people to live in these cities where they can be surveilled and detained and things like that. Cox kind of blew up at him and said, you don't get to make a word that I can't say on the radio, stuff up about me. And it got a little testy, but it kind of, I think it's a sort of a curious, kind of bizarre look at some of the theories that are going on out there, and you can check it out at SL Trip.
My Underplayed Story of the Week is Megan Banta's story on who is applying for student loan relief, kind of an analysis by county. And the upshot is that if you're applying for this, you're more likely to live in counties with more diversity, lower income, or both. Kind of an interesting story. We have just about 30 seconds. I want to turn back to Brian Maffley. Have you give me your 30-second version of an update? We talked, I think it was last week, on this Morgan County resort for the super rich. You have a kind of a follow-up here. A judge is going to make a decision on whether Morgan County residents are going to get to revisit this, right?
Yeah, so we alluded to this in our initial reporting, but yeah, there's multiple lawsuits pending before Judge Noel Hyde up in Morgan. One of which was went to trial last week, which is in the paper we posted today, has to do with these five Morgan County residents who are trying to get the county to hold a voter referendum, to challenge this ordinance that's allowing the resort to move forward. And then next week, the same judge is hearing some interesting motions. They're filed under seal, so we're not exactly sure what they're saying, but it has to do with these same five people's counter lawsuit against the developers, alleging that, the developer suit against them was filed in bad faith, and they're seeking punitive damages. So, so there's a lot there. The dockets on both these cases have, over 300 entries. Good luck wading through it. the judge Hyde will hopefully issue a ruling on the referendum matter fairly soon.
Okay.
And we actually talked about this last week.
Right, we did, yeah.
Well,
we'll have to leave it there. And that's why we rely on Brian Maffley to wade through all that. So Brian Maffley's been with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Blake Apgar, thank you. And Palak Jaiswal, thank you for being with us. And Robert Gerke. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Behind the Headlines.